I chose that title because cottonwood is really not only a tree for all seasons, and we'll show you how it takes care of virtually all seasons, but also for many reasons, for many uses. It sees beyond its sort of natural occurrence along river systems. Namely, it's also a plantation tree for lumber, fiber, and biofuels. It's more recently, I would say, in the last 15 years, has become a very interesting and very effective cleanup tree to clean up pollution sites. And then it's also, in the last 5 years, I would say, it has become a worldwide accepted model system for the study of tree biology and genetic engineering. So it really has many, many purposes. And in my talk, I'll just give you sort of a mini overview over some of that. Well, cottonwood, of course, is a key component of our riparian ecosystems. It starts from scratch, on sand, on gravel. A new generation of trees prepares the ground over its existence as a pure stand of cottonwoods by providing, you know, nutrients and so on, decomposing foliage, twigs and whatnot, building up the soil underneath, making it available for shrubs and eventually other tree species that are shade tolerant, and eventually gives the space, you know, to those species because it peters out at about 100 years of age. It cannot reproduce in its own shade. It must look for another newly disturbed site. And of course, river dynamics seems to provide that quite regularly. That's a typical flood on the Snoqualmie River. Again, the same site that we just looked at a moment ago with Mount Si in the background. The river at this particular site at Three Forks Park, at 20,000 cubic feet per second, water discharge is called a flood. Here we're looking probably at about a 30,000, okay? So it's quite a bit more. And this happens typically, of course, in fall or early winter, especially after rain on snow events, where snow hasn't settled yet, rain comes into it, and it melts immediately, and you get a spike, you know, in river discharge. This happens usually once or twice at such a level, maybe two or three times during winter, also at a lower level, medium flow, and so on. But certainly creating new kinds of conditions and changing typically the channel of the river. What you can see here is that the river carves in, of course, typically on the outside of the meander. It drops trees that have been standing there. These are cottonwoods, old cottonwoods that have been standing there. And it transports them further down, deposits them, and so forth. And on the inside, it accumulates, it deposits, you know, new gravel and sand. So there's an erosion and accretion process going on in the river. And the river channel gradually moves this way, okay, in a meander, okay? So 5 years from now, we couldn't stand here anymore, okay? Or we'd get wet. So river channels in a free-flowing river never stay at the same place. That's an important general lesson about river dynamics, okay? Cottonwood is highly adapted to that. In fact, requires this for its own reproduction. Here you can see what happens in end of May, usually this year, probably middle of May, early June. Namely, it sheds its cotton. That gives it the name, of course. And you can see in the cotton all these little dots. You know, these are the tiny little seed, about 2 millimeters long. If rain comes and taps it down onto the moist surface, these seeds will germinate within 24 hours. They don't waste any time. No dormancy. In 24 hours, they send down a little root, and this root will go down at the rate of about 1 inch, or a little bit less, maybe half an inch per day, okay? And on top, you have this tiny little seedling shoot system, which is about 2 inches tall and has about 3 or 4 tiny little leaves. I mean, it's a minimum factory of photosynthesis that feeds a root that goes down, you know, at a very high rate. It's a very thin root. It's as fine as a human hair, a minimum allocation of carbon, but it keeps in touch, ideally, with the receding water level in spring, okay? This is it's timed to match more or less the receding water level after spring snow melt, okay? And this tiny little root, you know, really goes down, and there's virtually nothing growing on top yet. And everything is allocated vertically down, you know, to this root. So in order to stay in touch with water, because that's very critical for survival, okay? The seed itself has really didn't get any nutrients in the nutritious tissue of an endosperm surrounding the embryo. It's a bare minimum package of a seed coat, and inside is an embryo, so it doesn't come with any nutritional supplements, you know, that are provided by the maternal tree. So it's entirely on its own. Here you can see seedlings on a essentially sterile surface of gravel and sand. You might ask, how can they survive here? How can they grow? What sort of nutrients are they getting in a setting like that? What has been found out by Sharon Doty early, say about 2001 or 2002. Sharon Doty sits right in here, and she's actually a member of the College of Forest Resources, or the School of Forest Resources now, on the faculty. She found out that, in fact, these tiny seedlings have a rhizobium in it that is nitrogen-fixing. That is really, it was quite a major discovery. And the reason it had never been discovered before is because typically rhizobia and other nitrogen-fixing bacteria are in root nodules, okay? Well, not in poplar. Not in poplar. In poplar, they are in the shoot, not in root nodules. That's why they were ignored for so long. And now we know about it. And they serve a very, very essential function that you can well imagine here on this very sterile substrate. You know, there's virtually no nitrogen available. This, by the way, opened the perspectives, actually, to another dimension of tree growth or plant growth, namely the whole microbial flora that may reside inside and outside of plants that has lots to do, maybe with growth, with rooting, with defense against other bacteria or fungi. This is a new dimension that now is really flourishing in research, and largely because also we have far more precise tools to put our finger on, say, different species of rhizobium or other bacteria, because of the molecular tools that we have today available. They're much sharper, that can distinguish among many different bacteria and fungi in a very precise manner. Very important new development. So typically then what happens is in terms of cottonwood establishment via sexual means in river dynamics is that you have seed coming down, you know, it comes down from these trees, seed is coming down all over the place. But at the spring level of water, there's a critical zone here on a point bar that has the right moisture regime as this spring level is receding down to the summer level, which is low, of course, in our dry summers. And so there is a minimal zone here, or a relatively narrow zone, that has exactly the right regime of moisture that seedlings can keep track of or keep in touch with water, okay? And so you get then a new seedling cohort established, okay, that comes in addition to earlier cohorts, you know, that were established. And the you have this accretion that's happening, you know, over the years. You have erosion going this way and tumbling trees into the water. So the river channel gradually moves over here. This would be the outside of a meander. And so you have this succession of different cohorts, each uniform in age, each stemming from a different year. Not every year would you get such a new cohort established because the conditions in a given year may not be perfect. But this is probably about the most ideal, picture of such successive cohorts, you know, that are recorded here in a slide by Stuart Rood from the University of Lethbridge in Alberta. Rivers up there in the prairies are, predictably shifting their channels. Our rivers on the west side of the Cascades carry a lot more wood, you know, and woody debris, trees and so on. They often pile up. They often divert a channel, you know, in a new way. So the probability has a greater effect, I would say, on the ultimate channel morphology than in this particular picture. But again, successive cohorts, all individuals in this cohort would be the same age, okay? And so another thing I want to point out is, of course, then they grow up and they fight with each other. Their greatest competition is from others of their kind. And that is a very important concept, again, in understanding, actually, evolutionary processes when we think of natural selection. And Darwin already pointed this out, really. Natural selection happens not so much between species, but among individuals within species. That is the highest pressure of natural selection. Okay. Seedlings have another way of responding to potential problems that are associated with river dynamics. This particular seedling here actually got established last year, and then in the winter it got dumped on, and this was a stem. This was the stem of the seedling. It was up to here, got dumped on with sand, okay? And probably lost the root system that is way down here, okay? But it was able to add new roots out of the stem, okay? So it has a tremendous flexibility to actually add new roots out of the stem. What happens too is that these roots are capable of sending up shoots again, okay? So cottonwood has an amazing flexibility in its development and growth patterns. It can shift from roots to shoots and from shoots to roots depending on the circumstance. It does need quite a bit of oxygen to do that, and that's why often the lower roots may die off and the more oxygen carrying water up in here in this closer to the surface sustains these roots up there. Another way that cottonwood is capable of taking advantage of river dynamics is that in winter, is often in winter storms, you have breakage of branches and of twigs. They fall into the river and they get transported. They get embedded somewhere, you know, further down in a bank. And if they're alive when they broke off, they are then sending down roots, okay? And they send up a new shoot and, or several shoots. And you may have actually a whole row of young trees coming up from such an individual. So this is a copy of a tree that grew further up on the river. And that's a very effective way of asexual propagation. So both sexual and asexual propagation are very successful and take advantage of the typical river dynamics. And here then is a typical a sort of a scheme of the schedule of reproductive events in relation to the changing river flow. So starting from January, ending in December, that's a calendar year, river has in the November, December, January, and so on, has some occasional spikes in terms of floods, and then often low flows until you have snow melt, okay? Then it goes up to a mid-average level, okay? A fairly good size level of discharge, okay? And then a gradual decline here in the months of May and June and July, and to the summer low because of our dry summers, characteristic of the Northwest. And then again, a resumption of the water flow in the fall. And when you look at pollination, it's very early. And this is the most important, this and the next one are the two key timing events, I would say. A very short gestation period, seed formation, okay? Very, very short. This is the shortest of any tree. Most trees, virtually all other trees, have a seed formation that lasts for 6 or 7 or 8 months, okay? This one is shut off very early. That also explains the tiny little seed that have absolutely no nutritional additional tissue associated with them. Cottonwood tries to beat time, be ready for dispersal right here at this receding level of spring water, okay, where they can keep in touch with the receding level. So this is the seed dispersal, and ideally, you know, seedlings then catch the water and can survive before the very low summer period. Okay. Another aspect is the asexual propagation. As I said, you know, branch abscission, stem and branch breakage and so on happens mainly during winter, and root initiation in early spring. Okay. So as you can see, cottonwood and its reproductive systems are taking care of all seasons. They take advantage of all seasons and the typical recurrent events that happen during those seasons. So when we talk in more broader terms about adaptation, this is actually a nice way of looking at adaptation. And Richard Levins, who was a quantitative geneticist from New York, once gave a talk back in 68 here, and I really enjoyed how he phrased adaptation. Namely, he said, organisms may be viewed as systems of environmental tracking, making use of relevant ancestral experience. That's a very nice way of saying it. And especially when we plug in then, say this experience is encoded in their DNA. But DNA is more than a memory bank. It is the software that programs a tree's growth, development, and response to biotic and abiotic cues. In other words, trees are guided by ancestral experience. If the environment for many, many, many generations has repeated seasonal events and so on, summer, spring, fall, winter, spring, and so forth, associated precipitation, associated temperatures, if these kinds of systems have repeated themselves through natural selection, eventually DNA carried the cues to those recurrent events and guides now the next generations in responding to these, okay? Because those that made it, those that responded to these cues appropriately left more progeny than those that did not, okay? And those that did not probably were left by the wayside or left fewer progeny. So that's how to view, in general terms, adaptation. So far, so we have looked at sort of the timing of reproductive events and how they are tuned to river dynamics. And again, let me also point out, of course, that nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect out there in nature. You know, timing can be off by 2 weeks, by 1 week, whatever. Not each tree exactly is perfectly attuned. And of course, you may have unusual events, you know, that are breaking, so to speak, the precedent. So, but it's cottonwood is definitely more tuned, for instance, to these cyclic events in river dynamics than is alder. Alder cannot handle in the floodplain the river dynamics. Okay, it only can handle it on more safe sites, not disturbances as cottonwood can handle. Okay. Okay. Now we can also look at adaptation to climate. And a nice study was done by one of our doctoral students, Joan Dunlap, back in the 80s. And what she asked herself was, are cottonwoods on the west side of the Cascades along rivers different from those on the east side of the Cascades, although they are the same species? Because they should be experiencing very different environments. As you know, the east side of the Cascades is much drier and hotter in summer and so on. It's vastly different from the west side, which has a more maritime climate. So what she did, she sampled trees along the Nisqually River all the way up to almost to paradise, you know. And she had about 30 trees. And then she did the same with trees along the Yakima River on the east side from Snoqualmie River down to Yakima. Again, about 30 trees. And then she took cuttings from them, put them in a nursery, grew them for 1 year, and then made more cuttings from those trees. So now you have many copies of each of the trees that was sampled along these rivers. And some copies were planted at Puyallup in a common garden, and others were planted in a common garden in Wenatchee. So in these contrasting environments, okay? And then she studied them for 2 years. And so the idea is, of course, the basic concept is that if trees from the west side are grown on the east side and they still look like west side trees, obviously it is in their genetics, okay? And the same for the reverse. So reciprocal transplantation, but in carefully designed field experiments and so on, statistically randomized and so forth, you know, is the way how you can distinguish purely environmental impacts on individual trees and so on from those that really have a long history and are embedded in their DNA, okay? And what she found was that indeed, and at the moment, just look down here at the text, and not at the picture above, what she found was that yes, those from the west side actually had, even when grown on the in Wenatchee, had a larger stem volume, larger leaves, larger stomates, fewer stomates per square centimeter, and they were highly rust resistant, okay? Whereas trees from the east side had smaller stem volume, smaller leaves, smaller stomates, and more stomates per square centimeter, and were highly rust susceptible. In other words, they had traits that clearly were adapting them to a hotter, drier climate. Typical plants in drier and hotter climates have always smaller leaves, you know. They don't grow as much, of course, and therefore have less stem volume per unit time compared with, you know, west side trees. Also, small stomates, but more stomates. That may be counterintuitive. You might say, stomates, after all, those are the openings on the undersurface of leaves, okay, where gas exchange takes place and where photosynthesis takes place, but also where water comes out, okay, transpiration. So you might say, wait a minute. More stomates, you know, would mean more transpiration. Isn't that bad, you know, in a dry climate? The way you have to imagine that is that, and because that's been found time and again in many different plant species, the way to interpret that is that these plants, they take advantage of the early morning short period when it's cool and still reasonably moist, and during that time they go for broke, okay? They open all stomates, they do all the photosynthesis, okay, and then they shut them down, okay, for the rest of the day, all right? And so for that you need lots of stomates and small stomates. Small stomates are apparently more efficient, actually, than our large stomates. So these are really clear adaptations, and they were found to be true also when grown on the west side in Puyallup. So obviously this is, genetically anchored. Now, the interesting thing in addition she found was that along the east side, along the Yakima River, the upper trees, the Yakima River comes down here from Snoqualmie, okay, down. This is Klee Elum in here, Klee Elum, okay? And then you get out down here, out towards Ellensburg, okay? And what she found is that trees up here actually were more similar, not identical, but I mean more similar to the west side trees, because up here you have also still more moisture. It's cooler, and so you have more precipitation. It's cooler even in summer than it is further down. That's why you have forests here. That's why you have ponderosa pine. And then comes a major change when you get down here and you get out into the shrub steppe, okay? And it gets very dry, as you can tell here from this picture. And although the cottonwood stands are continuous along this river here, all along, and so on, there is a major change happening, genetically speaking, between here and there, okay? And in this transition period in Bristol Canyon is where the change happens to these kind of trees, okay? So the upper part here still has relatively, is more similar to that, and the lower part is much more similar to that, okay? And so you have a remarkable change over 10 miles. And imagine, pollen flies back and forth here, seed flies back and forth here. There's a lot of gene exchange between this. But apparently, natural selection is very, very strong and eliminates any, what you might say, contaminants coming from the other side, okay? So this then, we could say, is an ecological race formation along the Yakima River over a relatively short distance. And that has, of course, practical implications, again, for river managers and so on, and ecologists, riparian ecologists. We often find in lower river reaches no cottonwoods anymore because past history, you know, agriculture, grazing, and so on has dispatched them, and they are no longer there. And so it is very, whereas you might still find further up in creeks in less accessible areas that are less interesting for agriculture, you might still find plenty of cottonwood. And of course, the typical thing one would think one would then do is, well, grab some of the cottonwoods further up and plant them down there if you want to restore the vegetation along the lower rivers. That would be a serious mistake, okay? And in fact, we were involved with some Forest Service and BLM project that in fact proved that point, okay? Where deliberately upper and lower source trees were cloned and planted in the low, dry areas and so on, and they did not do well at all as compared to others that were taken from neighboring rivers where maybe there were still low at the lower elevation some cottonwoods around, okay? So that's important to remember. Okay, now, so far I've talked about what you can do, or rather how we study natural systems and their adaptation in cottonwood. But you can go beyond that and look at the 30 different species of poplars worldwide and begin looking at, could we maybe borrow some genes from some of them? Could we introduce, say, genes from this very drought-tolerant species, Euphratica, in northwest China? Could we borrow some of these, maybe put them into our native black cottonwood to breed some new clones or new material that would be more resistant to drought in the future, or that we could plant more, or especially if the climate is warming and so on? Some other traits that are of great importance, of great interest, for instance, are high salt tolerance of Euphratica. And for instance, Israel is a very, very active project investigating transfer of genes from these into poplars that could be planted in Israel, where you have a great deal of salinification of the groundwater, of course, because of high evaporation. So the question is, you know, what can you do in combination of traits from different poplar species? This is aspen. You know, aspen cannot, for instance, be hybridized with cottonwood, but it can be hybridized with other, with white poplar and other aspens, and more close relatives than our native black cottonwood. So there are ways to exploit, or say to combine and capture, you know, genetic material through breeding. And this is a typical scheme. This is actually an actual pedigree that we developed with Toby Bradshaw in the biology department now. Mating popular strike our native black cottonwood with the eastern cottonwood. And they are vastly different from each other, really. They are adapted to very different kind of environments and different sites and so forth. And then you get an F1 population from crosses like that. And you can see whether that is a good material to work with. Or you can go to the F2 by mating these F1s with each other. And usually what you get in the F2 is a highly varied generation, tremendous variability among it, because you have now a lot of the genes are recombining and so forth. And, you know, this goes all the way back to the Mendelian experiments, you know, 1850, where he found out really, where he was looking for, are genes responsible for tall peas versus dwarf peas or wrinkled peas versus round peas and so forth, and found out, yes, indeed, there is a single gene, say, that may be responsible for that difference. Okay, well, usually there are more genes, you know, varied and so on than just single genes. In any event, this is kind of a pedigree. We call that a pedigree with grandparents, parents. You know, this is a back cross way of going in mating an F1 hybrid again with a parental, okay? And then you get not quite as much variability as here. The point I also want to make is that a pedigree, this particular pedigree, family 331 and 342, had a total of 600 progeny, okay, 600 progeny, and they were copied. You can make copies of each of these genotypes, okay? They were copied like you would send them, you know, through a copying machine, all right? Copied and outplanted in multiple copies in France, in England, in Italy, in China, and studied in different environments in a coordinated fashion. And these researchers then compare notes on very specific traits and so on and see how do genes respond to these environments. You cannot do that with animals. No way you can do that with plants. And cottonwood is one of the prime examples. You could do that with willows too. You cannot do it with virtually any conifer, okay? You can do it with eucalypt also. So broadleaf tree species are far more conducive to these kind of manipulations where you can really get insight into the genetic underpinnings of how they grow, how they respond to different climates, how they may prepare for new kind of climates, how they defend against insects and so forth. Okay, very, very elegant experiment on a big scale that you can conduct that way. Well, this is now, but you can also stop at the F1, generation. This is a hybrid between the eastern cottonwood and our native black cottonwood, and it is being harvested. This is planted down in the lower Columbia River Valley by James River Corporation. Now it's called Greenwood Resources. Yeah, but they grow, you know, about 10 feet a year, and they're harvestable, especially for pulp and paper, you know, after 7 years. It would take Douglas for, 20 years to do that, okay? So there's a new production system is possible that you can plant on marginal farmland and has proved to be very successful. This would be an F2 of that pedigree I was mentioning, okay? This is the F2 pedigree plantation. And what you can see here is these are all full sibs, and each individual has been copied. So these are two copies, or you could say identical twins, okay? Genetically identical, that have been planted right here, and they have been planted in several other places in the same plantation, so they are replicated, okay? But you can see in November, this was 15th of November, I think, they have shed already all their leaves. The ones back here, two others, or I mean one genotype, have still all their leaves on. This one here has shed part of its leaves, you know, but not all. And this one is further along in shedding leaves and so on. So if you're interested in finding out how do trees respond to seasonal cues in shutting off growth, for instance, in the fall, that is how to get to it, okay? That's one way to get to it, and there are new ways of doing that, and that is by genetic engineering, and this is again a huge topic. This is probably the worst looking slide, but in any event, it just gives you the idea that you can take tissue from a young cottonwood, put it in a medium and so on, propagate it and so forth, and then you can use an Agrobacterium tumefaciens, for instance, an Agrobacterium that occurs in nature and typically invades plants, okay, causes tumors, and you can disarm that. And that has all been, actually research on that has been done again here at the University of Washington in the microbiology and biochemistry department. And you can then attach to this Agrobacterium some genes, either from another species of cottonwood, say, or from even another plant. In fact, you could even introduce some genes from an animal, and all of that has been done. And you can then grow these that you have infected, and you would have to select those that seem to show. Not all of them show this infection that have been successful and whatnot and expressing itself the way you'd like to have it. And you have to make screen a large number before you may find one or two or three that actually seem to do what you are after. And then you can copy that and root it and so forth and test it in the greenhouse and then eventually test it, of course, outside. Okay? So genetic engineering is now, again, this is possible, it's popular, it's also possible with willow, it's also possible now with eucalypt, not with conifers. So these new molecular tools have really opened new opportunities. And the complete sequencing of a populous trichocarp of a black cottonwood genome, the word genome is missing in here, I just found out, you know. Complete sequencing of the genome of a individual tree of our native black cottonwood from the Nisqually River has been carried out. And this is the first tree worldwide that actually had its whole complete genome sequence. It means you have a complete list of the genes. You still don't know what they're doing, but in parallel studies with that, you can actually look at how many genes, and there are 45 to 50,000 genes, actually. Humans have 30,000 genes, so poppers have more, okay? So how many genes, for instance, are associated with wood formation? How many genes are associated with defensive compounds and so forth? How many genes are associated with more growth and differentiation and so forth? Okay. And these molecular tools have really led to a better understanding of basic tree biology. In other words, that's really how, you see, hybridization, you could say, is almost a clumsy approach to figuring out how the genetic machinery works behind the scene, okay? Whereas these tools now are far more precise and far more refined. And they also allow tracking adaptation to climate change in a more sensible way, more precise way. They allow more targeted and sustainable plantation production. You can introduce, say, genes for higher salt tolerance or for higher drought tolerance, things of that sort. And also, as Sharon Doty, who is working on phytoremediation, has already shown that you can actually tailor poplars for very specific cleanup jobs of particular chemicals in the soil. So you could develop a clone that just satisfied that very, very specific demand, and that's the only place where you would plant that. But for that purpose, it is better than anything else, okay? So these are really new molecular tools, and they have become very, very important. And this has made poplar basically a model tree for study worldwide. Okay, so take home lessons. The many adaptations of cottonwood to the riparian and climatic variables, obviously, as we have shown, have a very strong genetic basis. The second take home lesson I would say is that genetic manipulation of poplar species has opened the door to new uses of these trees and made old uses more effective. And perhaps the most important take-home lesson from this lecture is that to understand nature, we have to poke it, which means that we shouldn't only study and describe it, but we must challenge it with experiments to reveal its inner workings. And this is especially important in a rapidly changing world in which the past is an unreliable precedent for the future. Thank you.